All right, Alexander, let's talk about U.S.-China relations. And I want to go maybe 3 to 6 months back, where we did a lot of videos as the Trump-Xi trade negotiations were going on and the tariff deals were being hammered out between China and the United States. And we mentioned many times in our videos, and we did several videos on this topic, that the U.S. and China we're going through some sort of divorce, a slow motion type of divorce, a friendly divorce in a way. It wasn't too antagonistic, but there was an understanding on both sides, both the US and the Chinese side, that each country was kind of going their own way, and eventually they would be pitted against each other, as the number one economy against the number two economy, going at it in the world. And now we have the corona, and it seems that it's sped everything up times 100 in this divorce, and it's made it a lot nastier as well. So what are your thoughts on what's going on between relations between the US and China?
I think this is exactly right. Now, let's just do a quick overview of US-Chinese relations. Obviously, there was a long period after the Communist Party came to power in China in 1949, when the US firstly didn't recognize the new government in China, and then when they did, they still remained antagonistic to it. This continued from the 1949 until the early 1970s. And then Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger went to China. They met Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai in Beijing and Shanghai. By the way, I've been to the hotel in Shanghai where they all met, and they came to agreements, and gradually China and the US began to open up to each other, partly as a geopolitical move, because they were both pitted against the other great power, the Soviet Union, Russia. And they needed to make common cause, or felt they needed to make common cause against the Russians. So there was this period in the 70s where there was this gradual tentative opening up. And then from the 1980s, the late 1980s, this evolved into a very, very close economic relationship. And that involved the US opening up its markets to Chinese goods, US companies investing and transferring production to China, where they were benefiting from low Chinese wages. And there was a time, and I can remember this, when people in Europe were becoming very nervous, and they were saying that this is a huge economic bloc which is emerging, and the US and China are becoming so interconnected and interdependent economically that, they will dominate the planet for forever. And there was even an expression at that time, Chimerica, that this was, China, America, this giant economic bloc. I never took that very seriously, by the way, because in my opinion, politics always in the end wins through. And I never could see China accepting any kind of long-term partnership with the US, which would keep China in a position of subordination to the US. And I think what happened was that over the last couple of years, but especially since Barack Obama, since during the in Barack Obama's time, after the 2008 financial crisis, the US began to realize that China was not, in fact, the great ally and friend and subordinate that many people in the Democratic Party, especially, had thought it might be, that in fact, those tr factories that were transferred to China had built up, had helped to build up China into being this gigantic economic and industrial competitor. And there was growing disenchantment in the US, and that eventually culminated, first under Obama, into a turn on the geopolitical axis. The US did this pivot to Asia, which was all about basically containing China militarily and politically in the Pacific. And then, of course, there was Donald Trump came along, and he took it even further. And he said that the Chinese have been waging this trade, waging, winning trade advantages from the US, which have undermined the US industrial economy, and he was not going to allow it anymore, and that he would change the balance of the trading relationship, and he would impose tariffs on Chinese goods to make it happen. Now, actually, that is the arc. I happen to think that Donald Trump's actions were logical and were intended in the long term to help the US preserve its industrial structures. I think that these arguments that I see from some people in the Democratic Party that these trade wars were weakening the US were completely wrong. I think that there was the need both for the US to start to repatriate those industries and to build up its rebuild its industrial base in a way that would not have been possible if it had remained linked to China. And on the Chinese side, the Chinese needed to get away from this position of being dependent on exports to the US so that they started to rebalance their economy towards domestic consumption. So despite some very hard words that were said and some very inflammatory anti-Chinese comments that were being made in the US, this is a logical policy which had, you know, sound basis behind it. And I think Donald Trump was always able to keep it just within the, you know, moderate language at the right moments, cut deals with Xi Jinping at the right moments, keep everything on track towards this necessary, I stress, necessary and amicable divorce, which was coming. And in the end, you would have had two great economic powers, the United States and its allies in, you know, North America and Europe, China and Russia and all the others. And there would have been obviously also political and geopolitical adversaries, but there would have been a balance and it would also have been amicable. And adversaries, I always say this, is not the same as enemies. Now, along comes Corona, and the whole language has changed, and it has changed radically and disastrously, and in a way that I think will never really cannot realistically be repaired, because the US is criticizing China and in some ways criticizing China very aggressively for covering up the Corona crisis for 2 months, and can I just say quickly, I think there's a lot of reason to accept that criticism. I think there's a lot of force behind that criticism. I don't like some of the language that's been used. And I also don't like the fact that some people in the US are not understanding that after those 2 months, the Chinese did in fact respond to the crisis and did take it seriously. And the Chinese, for their part, are furious at some of the criticism that they see coming out of the US. And they see the US hiding behind anti-Chinese bashing, as they see it, in order to promote the policies of certain US politicians and in order to deflect from the US's own failures to deal with this crisis in an effective way. And I am going to say again, I think there is force to that criticism too. But the result is that instead of an amicable and incremental divorce, we're now getting everything happening at supersonic speed. So economic and trading relations between China and the US have basically come to a stop. Chinese exports have crashed, not just towards the US, but across the board, as demand across the global economy is collapsing. And the two countries are engaging in furious recriminations against each other. And I have to say, because I follow the Chinese English language media, much of which consists of translations of what the Chinese are writing domestically, the Chinese are giving as good as they're getting. So we hear all these furious denunciations of China in the US, and they are being equaled or surpassed by equally strong denunciations of the US in China. So we are unfortunately moving into a situation where these two countries are not just seeing each other as adversaries in trade, in economics, and in geopolitics. They're starting to think of themselves, each other rather, as enemies also.
Yeah, I agree with that, Alexander. The more the U.S. Lays blame on China for what's going on, the Chinese, to their detriment, I think. I'm not a fan of what they're doing in this case, but they're also coming out and they're spreading some ridiculous theories with the Quran as well, that it was started by the U.S. military and the U.S. is to blame. And that, and you just said, talking about state TV and state press, that's coming straight out of the state media, that they're floating these ideas. And then the U.S. comes back and they, you know, it's just tit for tat. It's not good.
It's not good at all. I mean, it is a Cold War type climate now. And I mean, I lived through the Cold War. These are the later stages of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the U.S. And I remember these propaganda exchanges that used to happen then. And this is exactly like that. I mean, it is taking that exact form, except, of course, that it's worse this time because people in the U.S. and in China are directly affected. So the Chinese are now saying, you know, this corona thing. And I mean, can I just say, I completely agree with you what the Chinese were saying about this being a bioweapon launched against them, or hinting that it might be that. It's disgraceful. It's completely wrong. And that, you know, it was the US military somehow infiltrated it into China. I mean, that is a nonsensical idea. And no one who understands the dynamics of this crisis can seriously believe that. And so they're saying terrible things about the US. And of course, the US is saying terrible things about them. So when two people talk like that to each other, it's never forgotten, including between states. And I think we're going to move now into a system, into a world afterwards, when the Chinese and the US see each other no longer as partners, no longer just as adversaries, but frankly, as enemies too. And can I say the other thing that's happening, and this is again so like the first Cold War, is that each side has been claiming the superiority of its system in the way that it handled this crisis. So the US has been saying, you know, the Chinese, you know, because they're secretive dictators and authoritarians, they covered it all up. And the Chinese are saying, because the US is decadent and dysfunctional, it can't control this thing. And, you know, each is making ideological points about the other, which is hardening the anger and is emphasizing the difference. It's making it now for the first time into an actual ideological dispute, which the US and China have up to very recently managed to avoid.
That's an excellent point, Alexander. I believe the corona situation has really pushed the US and China into a Cold War situation. Yes. And it completely reminds me of the United States and the Soviet Union. But there's one interesting difference, which I would like you to elaborate on, and we'll close out the video on this. When the US was going against the USSR, they weren't partners as well in the global economy. No. But in this situation, you definitely have the beginning of a Cold War, definitely between the United States and China.
Yes.
But you have this fact, this very real fact, that so many American companies are operating in China. So many Chinese products, including many of the drugs that the US uses, are manufactured in China. I mean, economically, they're inseparable. So how does, practically speaking, how does this Cold War work? I mean, do American companies leave? Do the Chinese look for new markets? Is there a better market than the United States? I can't think of one.
No. Well, I mean, the only possible market China has is itself. I mean, it has to change the structure of its economy, which, in fairness, it's been doing to some extent for some time now, but he's going to have to do that to an even greater extent than before. And by the way, just for people to know, China is now running a deficit. Its trade is now actually in deficit because he can't export. So it's got to adjust to that huge change in reality. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the Soviet Union and the United States operated in different economic universes. The Soviet Union had a completely closed economy. It did trade to small extent with outside countries. And of course, it did trade with its own East European satellite states to a certain degree. But even that was very, very controlled. It had a closed, controlled economy. It was in no sense an economic and commercial rival with the United States. China and the US are, as you correctly say, very integrated with each other, because of this long history of partnership of the Chimerica, this legacy of Chimerica, which is still there. So, you know, all these companies, I mean, Tesla was opening a factory in Shanghai just a few weeks ago before all this really began to take off. So you still have that the momentum left over from that time. And of course, the Chinese are out there in every market in the world, selling their products, coming, you know, up against the US, importing oil, as the US imports oil, or used to import oil. Actually, the US still imports oil. And of course, the Soviet Union never imported raw materials or oil or anything like that from anybody because it was self-sufficient. So you have a commercial rivalry as well as a geopolitical rivalry. We've never been in this situation before at any time in history. In modern history, since the First World War. Before the First World War, Germany and Britain were commercial as well as geopolitical rivals. And that's the world we are looking at again. We have geopolitical rivalry, we have financial, economic, commercial rivalry. We have two economies, the US and the Chinese, which bear much more resemblances to each other than the old Soviet economy did to the US economy, which is completely different. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, because we are looking at a rivalry of a sort that we've not had since 1914. And how this is going to work and how this kind of relationship is going to be managed, it's very difficult to say. One thing that did happen during the Cold War is because the two superpowers of that time, the Soviet Union and the United States, were not commercial and economic rivals. They were not, you know, competing each other against each other for markets or you know, on the world of commerce or even in the financial system in the way that the US and China are, is that it was actually very easy to preserve the parameters of the relationship. I mean, I used to remember, you know, there used to be Soviet U.S. summits, you know, Kosygin meeting Johnson, Brezhnev meeting Nixon, and then Gorbachev meeting Reagan, or even going back further still, Khrushchev meeting Kennedy. They were able to talk about, you know, we've got troops here, you've got troops there, we'll get cut down on these weapons, and you cut down on that weapon. It was actually fairly straightforward to do because on economics, they didn't clash. But this time, it's not going to be that straightforward because on the economics, they do clash on or conceivably clash on so many levels. There's another important difference, by the way, which is, of course, the Soviet Union was overwhelmingly a land power. It did have a powerful fleet and it had a large submarine fleet, a large nuclear submarine fleet. But because it was not a major trading power, it didn't have a large surface navy. So, you know, the USSR never developed aircraft carriers, for example. China is building aircraft carriers. It has a massive naval program, partly because it needs a big navy to challenge the US as a commercial rival. And of course, challenging the US Navy is, in a way, a kind of military challenge that the US has never had before, because it challenges US control of world trade routes. So this is going to be a much more messy and complicated and difficult Cold War than the previous one. And it's going to be fought in different ways and in different levels. And it's difficult to know how this is going to play out. But we will see. We live in very, very interesting times. But you're absolutely right, you say the corona has exacerbated it, and it has accelerated it in completely unexpected and perhaps ultimately bad ways.
Yeah, I agree with you. And we can't forget that it was Obama that wanted to pivot to the South China Sea,
Yeah,
correct? And he
absolutely
never
right.
did it. He ended up focusing on the Middle East and just,
Yeah.
laying waste to what was going on in the Middle East. But he wanted to pivot towards Asia, and the South China Sea is going
Yes.
to be a hot spot. I mean,
Absolutely.
that's China's backyard outside of Australia, New Zealand, whatever's, in that area
Yeah.
that's aligned with the US. You're pretty much looking at the Chinese, territory there, are you not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And can I just say, and I'm sorry, I'm going to go back into my anti-Obama bashing mode. What a disastrous thing that was. Because what Obama did, of course, he went in for the, he pivoted to Asia. He talked about, he brought up this question of the South China Sea, which is extraordinarily sensitive for China. It's as sensitive as the Soviet Union laying claim to the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, it's just, you should never have done that. And of course, he had this extraordinary Trans-Pacific Partnership idea, which is all about locking the other Asian economies into the US. Trump, thankfully, has ditched that disastrous plan. But the South China Sea, the military aspect of this, which Obama launched, that was what triggered the Chinese naval buildup. Because the Chinese were saying, if the US is going to challenge us with their naval forces in the South China Sea, we have to build up a navy that is going to challenge that of the US. And that has launched a naval race, which the US has never been in before. The Soviets never challenged US control of world sea lanes. That was not what they were about. The Chinese potentially are, initially, it will be to, regain control or to gain superiority in the South China Sea. But if you start building aircraft carriers, which is what the Chinese are doing, and you start building 15,000 ton missile destroyers, which is what the Chinese are also doing, and if you're building them at the rate that the Chinese are currently building them, which is frenetic, and which will presumably resume at that same frenetic place as the Chinese industrial economy revives, then the US is in a naval race with a massive industrial power and a commercial a rival. And how will the US respond? The US has extraordinary resources, and it will try, I think, to respond. But the fact is, we are again looking at a situation much more like the one which existed between Britain and Germany before the First World War, where the Germans also were challenging British control of the seas. They were engaging the British in a naval arms race in order basically to pursue a policy of trying to establish Germany as a great commercial power in rivalry to Britain. And that was part of the tension that led to the First World War. We hope nothing like that will happen again, but it's a completely changed dynamic from the one we've known in the past.
All right. Alexander Mercurs, editor-in-chief of the Durand. Thank you very much, guys. If you like this video, click on the subscribe button down below. Click on the notifications bell and smash that like button. Also, look for us on SoundCloud and iTunes for an audio copy of this video. And please donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, and Subscribestar. Your donation helps keep this channel up and running, and we appreciate all the donations very, very much. And of course, we appreciate it when you go to the Durant shop and purchase some merchandise. We've got magic mugs, and we've got awesome polo shirts like the one Alexander is wearing. And I saw you also have a magic mug there. I
Indeed,
believe
I do.
Lavrov, and it was his birthday.
It was his birthday. This is why I've brought it out, actually. He was 70 years old. And can I just say, by the way, 70 years old, he's a chain smoker. So he's got to be careful these days, because he's the world's best foreign minister, but he's also in that very, very vulnerable group as we face this medical crisis that we're looking at. But, you know, good wishes to Mr. Lavrov on his birthday. Mr. Putin apparently gave him an award. And we're talking about, we were talking in this program about the US-Chinese Cold War that is now underway. And it needs, that will need management by skilled diplomats like these. No one in the United States has his diplomatic skills. And to be perfectly frank, what I've seen of Chinese diplomats doesn't inspire me either. They've got to start learning the kind of skills that people like him developed during the Cold War to manage this complicated relationship that they're facing. But let's not just focus on Mr. Lavrov. This is a magnificent mug that we've been talking about. It is one of our amazing and historic and famous magic mugs. And the reason it's magical is because it keeps your tea hotter and your coffee hotter for longer than any other mug will do. I can vouch for that. It'll also keep your beer and your champagne cold, and it will sustain you for hours through the long watches of the night if you're doing what I do and what Alex does, which is follow the news and keep track on it. I mean, you know, we both work, I should say this, for hours and hours and hours so that we can stay on top of these very complicated stories that we discuss with you. And we wouldn't be able to do it without the sustenance that we get from our magic mugs. And I would add, it's beautiful to hold. It's strong, it's light, it looks amazing. It's got this extraordinary gloss that tells you that you've got a really beautiful porcelain body with this wonderful glaze. And it's also extremely strong. I mean, I am somebody who breaks and chips and cracks all sorts of things. I've had this mug for over a year and it's in perfect condition. So get yourself a magic mug and you'll get the best mug you have ever had. And get yourself more than one, because they come in many shapes, many other emblems and legends. So magic mugs, and as Alex correctly says, amazing polo shirts like the one I'm wearing now. I wear my polo shirts to many glittering occasions. It is the epitome of smart casual. At the moment, because of the crisis, I have to wear it at home. But I wear it at home because it keeps me in such a good mood, because it's wonderful to wear such smart clothes and they always help your morale in difficult times like these. But there will be better days very soon. And when they come and you want to meet your friends, and to party, perhaps, if you're the sort of person who likes to party, well, you couldn't be better dressed than in a beautiful polo shirt like this. 100% cotton, fits amazingly, and it's even got the double-headed eagle of the Durand there. And we don't just make it in this beautiful dark blue color. It comes in many, they come in many colors also. And we also have other shirts. We have equally fine and beautifully made T-shirts, all 100% cotton, some of them long-sleeved, some of them short-sleeved. We also have V-neck shirts. We also have hats and hoodies and stickers. And we also have our amazing ebooks looking at subjects like Ukraine Gate and Russia Gate and Epstein and Brexit. You can inform yourself about all of these subjects, which have not really gone away. We shouldn't forget them, by going to our ebooks. So you can help the Durand and you can help yourself through these difficult times so that we can provide you with all this commentary and so you can be the owner of these wonderful things and also feel good in yourself when you wear shirts like this. Come to our shop, support the Durand. Alex will tell you how.
Just look in the description box down below, thedurandshop.com. Alexander Mickers, Editor-in-Chief of The Durand. Thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.